From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Israel steps up attacks in Gaza offensive. Germany expels U.S. spy chief. Pakistani offensive empties biggest town in militant sanctuary. A big rebound for the Great Whales. Those stories and more coming up. Good morning. I'm Ray Kugel. Israeli warplanes relentlessly attacked Gaza Strip targets in the third day of a campaign aimed at ending rocket attacks. Hamas militants are firing on Israeli cities. Palestinian officials say the three-day death toll has reached at least 85 militants and civilians. Israel reports no casualties. Robert Berger has more from Jerusalem.
Israeli warplanes struck more than 320 targets in Gaza linked to the ruling Islamic militant group Hamas. The military said the strikes destroyed tunnel networks, rocket launching sites, and the homes of Hamas commanders. Since the offensive began on Tuesday, Israel has attacked more than 750 targets in Gaza. Israeli Army spokesman Peter Lerner says the aim of the operation is to stop waves of Palestinian rocket attacks that are threatening civilians.
Primarily, we are out to strike at Hamas. We can't allow them to keep Israel, those 1 million Israelis, living as hostages to their rockets.
While Hamas is the target, Palestinian civilian casualties are mounting. In the deadliest attacks, a family of eight was killed when a bomb hit a house, and at least eight others died when an airstrike blasted a Gaza beach cafe where people were watching the World Cup. Hamas is hitting back. It continues to fire dozens of rockets at Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, but many have been shot down by Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. Hamas spokesman Mushir al-Masri vowed the group would keep on fighting and strike at Israel from the land, sea, and air. Speaking in China, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry backed Israel.
No country can accept rocket fire aimed at civilians, and we support completely Israel's right to defend itself against these vicious attacks.
Kerry said the United States will do everything possible to try to bring an end to the violence. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fears there is risk of an all-out escalation in Israel and the Gaza Strip. He is calling for an immediate ceasefire. The UN chief spoke during an emergency meeting of the Security Council Thursday, as we hear from VOA's Margaret Bashir.
In his briefing to the council, Mr. Ban said that the only way to prevent an Israeli ground offensive is for Hamas to stop firing rockets. He urged the international community to speed up efforts to halt the escalation and reach a sustainable ceasefire.
We must not let spoilers prevail. We must keep the situation from getting any further out of control. Any further spiral of violence could have alarming, unforeseen consequences.
Palestinian envoy Riyad Mansour urged the council to act to protect the lives of Palestinian civilians, de-escalate the current crisis, and salvage the peace process.
A firm message must be sent by the council to Israel to immediately cease its aggression against the Palestinian people and to abide by its obligations under international law. Moreover, it is high time that Israel, the occupying power, be held accountable for its countless human rights violations and war crimes.
Palestinian leaders have previously warned that they would consider taking Israel to the International Criminal Court in The Hague to be tried for violations against Palestinians. Israel's envoy, Ron Prosser, said that in the hour the council met, six more rockets were fired from Gaza into Israel. Prosser said Operation Protective Edge is intended to protect Israeli citizens.
Over the last few years, Hamas has built up a massive military machine with 10,000 rockets. Israel is now acting to dismantle that machine.
After the meeting, Prosser said if the Palestinians want peace, the Palestinian Authority must end its partnership with Hamas. He said Israel cannot negotiate with a unity government that includes a terrorist organization that does not recognize Israel's right to exist. The envoy also urged the Security Council to condemn Hamas and its rocket attacks and support Israel's right to defend itself. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon named veteran diplomat Staffan de Mistura as his new envoy for Syria, where the civil war is now in its fourth bloody year. The Swedish-born de Mistura has spent more than 30 years at the UN in various diplomatic jobs, including some of the world's trouble spots. His posts included UN envoy to Afghanistan, and he's also served in Iraq and Lebanon. Mr. Bond says these experiences will serve him well.
He will bring all his expertise and experiences to these very difficult negotiations for peace in Syria. So I'm confident that he will be able to carry out his duty as special envoy.
De Mistura replaces Lakhdar Brahimi, who resigned in May. The leaders of Germany, France, and Russia are calling for a resumption of the ceasefire between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine that expired at the beginning of July. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande discussed the situation in eastern Ukraine in a three-way phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday. According to Mr. Hollande's office, he and Ms. Merkel stressed the need to quickly reach a political settlement that would include a ceasefire, development of a mechanism to monitor the Ukrainian-Russian border with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and the release of all hostages. Germany expelled a top U.S. intelligence official based in the country after two Germans came under investigation for passing secrets to the United States. VOA's Al Pessin has details.
The expulsion affects the chief of the U.S. intelligence section in Berlin, who has not been named. The head of the German Parliamentary Control Committee, Clemens Binninger, confirmed the decision after an emergency meeting. Binninger said the move came in response to what he called a continuous lack of cooperation in the investigation into several spying allegations dating back to last year. He was apparently referring to revelations that the U.S. National Security Agency spied on German chancellors for more than a decade. More recently, on Wednesday, German police searched the home of a man suspected of working with American intelligence. Local media said the man works for the German military. Last week, police arrested a German intelligence service operative they believe sold more than 200 secret documents to the United States. European Council on Foreign Relations Research Director Hans Kundnani says the spying has struck a strong chord among Germans.
The thing that you hear all the time in Berlin is that we understand that you spy on China and on Russia, but we don't understand why you spy on friends. The Germans say over and over again that the reason that there won't be a return to business as usual afterwards is because an element of trust has been broken.
Indeed, Chancellor Angela Merkel said Thursday Germany and the United States have very different approaches to intelligence work. Kundnani says the United States spies on Germany in part because the country has been taking a more independent line on foreign policy issues rather than following the U.S. lead as it did during the Cold War. He says examples include German opposition to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and its more cautious approach in response to the Russian invasion of Crimea. The U.S. Embassy in Berlin declined to comment specifically on the expulsion, but said the U.S.-German security relationship remains very important and keeps Germans and Americans safe. The embassy statement said it is essential that close U.S.-German cooperation continues in all areas. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
China is facing fresh allegations of cyber spying against the United States following discussion of the issue during high-level talks in Beijing this week. Quoting senior U.S. officials, the New York Times reported that Chinese hackers broke into a network that contains U.S. government personnel files. The officials say the incident took place in March and appeared to be an attempt to access the personnel files of tens of thousands of federal employees who've applied for top-secret security clearances. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security confirm an intrusion took place, but say they have not found any loss of personally identifiable information. 2 days of high-level diplomatic and economic talks between the U.S. and China have ended in Beijing, with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry praising collaboration between the countries. Secretary Kerry says much of the discussion focused on ideas rather than immediate action. The sixth round of the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue addressed issues ranging from climate change to economic reforms and diplomatic tensions with China's neighbors. Secretary Kerry is in Afghanistan to meet with the two presidential candidates who are squabbling over the results of last month's runoff election. Mr. Kerry will convey President Obama's message that the U.S. expects a thorough review of all reasonable allegations of fraud and will not accept any extra constitutional measures. Abdullah Abdullah and his rival Ashraf Ghani both claimed victory in last month's runoff to replace outgoing President Hamid Karzai. Preliminary results show Abdullah trailing Ghani by about 1 million votes. Military commanders in Pakistan say the army's ongoing offensive against terrorist groups in North Waziristan is progressing well. Ayaz Ghul reports from the region's administrative center of Miran Shah, where the Pakistani Taliban is headquartered, and the army says it found traces of foreign al-Qaeda operatives.
Since launching the much-awaited counter-militancy offensive nearly a month ago, the Pakistan Army flew a group of journalists to Miran Shah this week to showcase its gains made so far. The commander of the operation, Major General Zafarullah Khan, says troops have inflicted heavy losses on militants and the mission remains aimed at regaining government control over the entire North Waziristan territory.
It was no doubt the epicenter of terrorism. It was the nerve center, logistics and communication base for all terrorist groups and their activities. There was a presence of large number of local and foreign terrorists of all creeds and colors. And this place was also used to an extent for indoctrinating the minds of raw youth for suicide missions.
After months of signals from the military that it planned a large offensive in North Waziristan, aerial bombardment began in mid-June. Some 800,000 people have reportedly fled the region for temporary camps in nearby towns, where the army and aid groups are assisting the government in dealing with the humanitarian crisis. Khan says that although most of the territory around Miran Shah has been cleared of extremists, advancing troops face a daunting task of clearing a huge amount of improvised explosive devices or IEDs. He says the troops have found about a dozen bomb-making facilities and an underground network of tunnels. He says soldiers also found terrorist media production centers as well as armed caches.
The enormity of the task at hand is such that it is going to take time to clear the town of the IEDs. More than 23 tons of prepared IEDs are there in an area of about 1.5 by 1 kilometer.
Critics of the offensive have claimed that by giving ample warning ahead of the offensive, many militants have escaped. But the general says all efforts are being made to prevent that from happening, unlike previous army actions in tribal districts adjacent to North Waziristan.
We tried this time to strangulate them and seal off certain communication centers to deny them liberty of action, liberty of move in large scale. Now, having said that, it's not possible. Militarily, it's not possible to create a watertight or an airtight compartment where an individual terrorist cannot escape, given the context of the terrain.
The general claimed that so far there have been no civilian deaths in both airstrikes and the ground offensive. There are no independent monitors to verify the claim. He says it will be premature to speculate on the exact number of terrorists killed or whether most of them have escaped to nearby tribal areas or across the Afghan border. Reporters were then given a tour of the main market of Miran Shah and surrounding streets. The once bustling city now looks like a ghost town where the only residents besides the Pakistani soldiers appear to be a donkey and a couple of stray dogs searching for food in the garbage. A large number of shops were half open, suggesting workers quickly left the area to escape army shelling. Lieutenant Colonel Wajahat briefed reporters while standing inside a bomb-making facility.
We can easily call it an ID factory, a large sort of like a shed in which you can see the cylinders in abundance. And their numbers are crossing over 700. half of them are filled and half of them are ready to be filled. And basically these are the vehicle-borne IDs, most of them.
In addition to Al-Qaeda foreign operatives and the Haqqani network of Afghan insurgents, the Waziristan region has long hosted anti-China and Islamist militants from Uzbekistan. The Haqqani militants have conducted high-profile attacks against U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan, but Pakistan until now resisted pressure to go after these extremists because it is widely perceived they have links with the Pakistani spy agency. For the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by the fighting, it remains unclear when they can return home. Army commanders in North Waziristan say they have not set a timeline for the offensive. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Miran Shah, Pakistan.
The Iraqi government is asking for international help after Sunni militants from the group, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, seized nuclear material from a university. The request follows a militant takeover of an abandoned chemical weapons factory. Henry Ridgewell reports that weapons experts are playing down any major threat from the seizures.
That is purported leader of the ISIL militants, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, delivering a sermon last week at Friday prayers in the Iraqi city of Mosul. Heavily armed fighters from the group overran Iraq's second biggest city in June. The Iraqi government warned Thursday that the militants had seized up to 40 kilograms of uranium compounds from Mosul University. The speed of the Iraqi military's retreat from the rebels has left many sites unsecured, says Afzal Ashraf, counter-terrorist expert at the Royal United Services Institute.
There really wasn't time for them to do anything, and I don't think anybody ever really had a contingency plan, and that's something else that might come out of this, is to think about the sort of things that you might want to protect in the event that a city or a town falls.
In a letter to the United Nations, Baghdad appealed for international help to stave off the threat of the use of the nuclear material by terrorists in Iraq or abroad. But the International Atomic Energy Agency says the material is low grade and does not pose a significant risk. Again, Afzal Ashraf.
But what they could do if they were minded to do that and with a little bit of expertise is to make what people call a dirty bomb. And that's a conventional bomb where you pack some of this radioactive material around it so that when you explode this bomb, you contaminate a whole area around there.
The ISIL militants are also in control of an unused chemical weapons factory northwest of Baghdad. But experts say the munitions are degraded and unusable. A month after the rebels began their advance, the Iraqi government appears so far unable to wrest back the territory it lost. That will require engagement with local Sunnis alongside a military offensive, says Ran Jalaldin of the London School of Economics.
Much will depend on how the Iraqi state responds, whether that's with the Iranians, or the Turks, or the Americans even, and whether they can sustain or try and influence events in the Sunni Arab North, perhaps with the support of local tribes with more moderate Sunni actors.
But the Baghdad government appears even more divided. Iraq's Kurdish politicians announced a boycott of cabinet meetings Thursday after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki accused the northern autonomous Kurdish region of harbouring the Sunni militants. Observers say the dispute increases the likelihood that the Kurdistan regional government will attempt to break away from the Iraqi state. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Amnesty International published the names of people suspected to have committed human rights violations and war crimes in the Central African Republic. The human rights group says these individuals must be investigated and held accountable in order for the country to begin a peace and reconciliation process. Jennifer Lazuta reports from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The new report, entitled Central African Republic, Time for Accountability, turns a spotlight on high-profile members of the mostly Christian anti-Balaka and mainly Muslim Seleka armed rebel groups, who are suspected of having committed serious crimes against humanity. The CAR has been plagued by religious and intercommunal violence since Seleka rebels overthrew the president in a March 2013 coup. It is estimated that thousands have been killed and more than 1 million people have been displaced. Amnesty International has documented some of the abuses and crimes since then, which include rape, dismemberment, mutilation, and large-scale civilian killings. Amnesty International's CIR researcher Kristen Mukosa says most of the suspected perpetrators have enjoyed impunity, despite the fact that many of their crimes are known to authorities.
It's not acceptable that people who have been involved in serious human rights violations continue living freely in Bangui and in other places, especially in Bangui, where they are living just under the nose of the transitional authorities and the international community forces. This is unacceptable, and something must be done to ensure that investigations can start in those instances.
Some of the suspects, such as former President Francois Bozis and former Seleka leader Michel Djotodia, have been sanctioned by the United Nations and the United States for undermining the peace, stability, and security of CAR, but continue to move about freely. Others, such as anti-Balaka commander Richard Bajan and Colonel 12 Puissance, have spoken publicly about the crimes against humanity that they have committed and their role in inciting violence. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
In the heyday of commercial whaling during the 19th and 20th centuries, the giant marine mammals were killed by the tens of thousands. By the time an international moratorium was put in place in 1986, some populations had declined by an estimated 66 to 90%. Since then, whale populations have rebounded, and they are improving the ocean environment. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel explains.
Great whales are the largest animals in the history of life on Earth. You might know them by their names, baleen, sperm, humpback, blue, and gray. Valued for their meat and oil, they were once considered of little consequence to the ocean. But we know better now, says University of Vermont conservation biologist Joe Roman, lead author of a new study in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. It finds that great whales have a powerful and positive impact on how the ocean works. He spoke via Skype.
They can increase nutrients in areas where they're feeding. So whales dive deep to feed. They come to the surface, and as it turns out, they defecate or they release whale poop at the surface. That has lots of nitrogen and other nutrients, so it can increase productivity in the areas where whales are feeding.
Whales continue to service the ocean, even when they die and sink to the deep sea, Roman says.
That also brings nutrients down there and lots of habitats for species that depend entirely on those whale falls.
After centuries of decline, great whales are steadily repopulating their historic breeding and feeding grounds, and they have a healthy appetite. Some commercial fisheries argue the whales are eating too many other fish and taking a big bite from their profits. Roman says the opposite is true.
I think that the classic view was too many whales, not enough fish. But our study and several others are starting to show that it's far more complicated, more interesting than that. That is, when whales are in a healthy ecosystem, we can have more fish and more whales at the same time.
Roman argues whales are being blamed for poor fishery management.
If we can restore our waterways, if we can better manage our fisheries, we're going to find that we'll have more whales for us to enjoy, as well as more fish for commercial fisheries, for recreational fisheries.
But even as whales rebound, they are not immune to human threats in the ocean. They are run over by container ships, caught in fishing nets, and disturbed by noise from ocean traffic and sonar signals. Margaret Williams, who directs the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program, spoke via Skype.
So shipping is increasing in the Arctic. Plans for offshore oil and gas development are increasing. And so World Wildlife Fund is working with government and communities and industry and other conservation groups to identify those areas that are very, very important for whale species, for migration areas, for feeding areas, and we're recommending that those areas receive special management attention.
William says whales deserve this protection. They are, as the study underscores, more valuable than whalers ever imagined to us, to fisheries, and to the ocean itself. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On July 10th, 1509, French-born theologian, author, and preacher John Calvin was born. Calvin, one of the leading figures of the Protestant Reformation, explained his view of doctrine in the publication Institutes of the Christian Religion. Calvin has had a lasting impact on Western civilization. On this day in 1723, influential English jurist and teacher William Blackstone was born. Blackstone's lectures were published in his Commentaries on the Laws of England, a work that gave clarity to the English common law and had a significant effect on American jurisprudence. In 1925, the trial of high school science teacher John Thomas Scopes began in Dayton, Tennessee. Scopes was accused of violating state law that forbade the teaching of evolution because it contradicted the biblical account of creation. In 1940, German warplanes bombed a British convoy in the English Channel and dockyard installations in South Wales, marking the beginning of the 3.5-month Battle of Britain. On this day in 1962, the United States launched Telstar, the first active communication satellite into orbit, designed to transmit telephone, broadcast, and other high-speed data information around the world that helped to transform the way the world communicates. And on July 10th, 1987, the Greenpeace vessel Rainbow Warrior sank in New Zealand's Auckland Harbor after a bomb detonated near the ship's hull. One person was killed. The vessel had been preparing for a protest against French nuclear testing in the Pacific. It was determined later that the bombers were French agents acting on behalf of their government. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Chinese Christian pastor Zhang Xiaojie was convicted July 4th and sentenced to 12 years in prison in retaliation for his peaceful advocacy on behalf of his church community. The United States calls on Chinese authorities to release Pastor Zhang immediately and cease harassment of his family members and congregants. Pastor Zhang, chairman and president of the government-sanctioned Nanli County Christian Church in Henan Province, was convicted of gathering crowds to disturb public order and fraud, charges his lawyer called untenable and without foundation. The pastor was detained last November along with more than 20 other church members after a dispute with local officials, who they claimed were trying to seize the land on which their place of worship was built. "I strongly believe Zhang Xiaojie is innocent," said Liu Weiguo, a rights lawyer who has worked with the pastor in the past. He said this is a total setup by the local government. Pastor Zhang's supporters say this case highlights a growing crackdown on freedom of religion in mainland China as authorities grapple with a rapidly growing Christian population. Recently, some state-run churches have been demolished or had their crosses forcibly removed. Pressure is also mounting on rights advocates and lawyers in China. Several lawyers have been detained or formally arrested for attempting to defend clients, such as Cheng Boyang, who faces criminal charges in Zhengzhou, the capital of Henan Province, for trying to represent three people detained for attending a May commemoration of the June 4, 1989 crackdown on Tiananmen Square democracy protests. The United States calls on Chinese authorities to allow citizens to worship and gather freely in accordance with China's own laws and its international human rights commitments. Freedom of religion is critical to a peaceful, inclusive, stable, and thriving society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.